You are listening to Friends of Europe's podcast. Don't miss our debates on global and European issues that span political, economic, social, and environmental challenges, and follow our website at friendsofeurope.org.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome. Welcome to our panel discussion today on working towards a sustainable global food system. I'm Shada Islam. I'm Director of Policy at Friends of Europe, and I'm going to moderate this, I hope, stimulating and lively panel discussion. So for the next 60 minutes, we'll be exploring a number of very critical issues. I think we all know that providing enough food in a sustainable manner to a rapidly growing world population is one of the world's most important challenges. The paradox is that there is, in fact, as we all know, enough food for everyone. But there is a problem of access to this food, and we have problems of undernourishment and malnourishment as a result. So we'll be exploring some very important issues, as I said, and what should a sustainable global food system look like? What is needed to make it work? Where should we be focusing our efforts? And this requires an open, fair trading system, world trading system, rule-based trading system. The important role of smallholder farmers, especially women, is very important, very pivotal. Easy access to technology, investments in agriculture are important. It's also about private-public partnerships. There's an obvious link also to the climate change debate, of course, on sustainable development goals as well. And our challenge in this globalized and interconnected world is to bring these different strands of the global food system into one coherent whole, into one comprehensive sustainable food policy. So to discuss these issues today, we have with us a panel which is enlightened, knowledgeable, and has a great deal of expertise on these issues. To my left is Tassos Haniotis, Director at DG Agriculture and Rural Development. Welcome, Tassos. Robert Horster is Director at Cargill. I'm going to be very brief in reading out their CVs because you have the programs and you can read their very enlightened and very knowledgeable CVs, very distinguished panelists. Francesco Tremontin, Director of External Affairs Europe at Mondelez International. Thank you very much for being here, Francesco. And last but not least, Hans van Mild, Research Director in Food Security at Wageningen University. Now, the rules of the game are very simple. We have about an hour to talk about all these questions, very complicated, very complex questions, but these gentlemen are very well aware of the different questions and priorities they have to bring up. I have this very modern gadget, which will time your interventions, 5 minutes each. That is the rule. And when you start going beyond, I will interrupt you and gently guide you back to the main point. So, Robert, I'm actually going to start with you from Cargill. The $64 million question for you, obviously, is what has to be done, Robert, from farm to fork to feed the world in a sustainable way by, say, 2050?
Is this microphone working? Yes, it is. Good evening. Shada, it's indeed a $64 billion question, probably. And, yes. And let me start by saying that when you think about it from the perspective of a company like Cargill, we would be in a unique position to bridge the gap from deficit to surplus, from farm to fork. I think a company like ourselves is in relevant international networks where we can actually work with a number of stakeholders, including NGOs and policymakers. So the key here is that not only that is the situation, but also we have knowledge to share. We've been in agriculture for 150 years. We've been moving crops around the world for the same amount of time. We've been in food processing for the same amount of time. And I think, if I'm being slightly modest, I would say we have a bit of knowledge on how we move crops. Now, the problem is, as you rightly pointed out, there is sufficient food. There's enough calories for everyone, but it doesn't reach the people. I mean, it reaches people, but it reaches not enough people. And if you look over the last 4 decades, yields have improved. In fact, yields have doubled for the 16 major crops in the world. And yields will continue to improve for the next 4 decades, but maybe not as fast. The problem is that there's a lot of drags, a lot of challenges, if you will, to increasing food production. And I name just a few. For instance, GDP growth. I mean, we're all happy that GDP grows. But first of all, it's not growing evenly. Second, with GDP growth comes what we call dietary expansion. So if you look at the increase of income, the consumption of processed food increases exponentially beyond a certain threshold. So this is number one. Number two, I would have the fact that food is not grown where it is produced. If you think of the world as with an economic center, and you look at where the economic center is moving, it's moving east and slightly south. But the most important observation is moving away from food production, which means that as population grows, food has to cross borders much more than it has today. There's two big problems. First of all, trade is not always free. Second, if you think about where that, if you think about the most fertile regions that have been undeveloped, it's Africa, where also investment is underdeveloped. Now, if you then add the climate change, which is a huge uncertainty that we all need to deal with, I mean, you can see the number of challenges that we're faced with. So then, to finish off, because I see time is almost up on your 21st century device. Okay, where could we help? So Cargill, first of all, is in a position to help by investments in infrastructure. From my own experience, I was in China for a number of years. I've seen what good infrastructure does to moving crops. It literally unlocks regions. It literally brings growth. It literally brings food to customers. It lowers costs in the supply chain. Right, so this is number one. I would say another thing would be investments in food science and processing technology. I would say then, if you go back to my very first point, which is, I mean, our global reach, if you will. I mean, we are at this crossroads between a number of stakeholders, including NGOs and governments, and also our customers, of course. So here's where we think we have a role to play in, including everyone in supply chains, including the smallholders. Because if you think about, and I'll finish off with this example, if you think about the supply chain in palm oil, the most important origin for palm oil is Indonesia. 60%, of palm oil production comes from smallholders, which we define very broadly as less than 5 hectares, which is huge already. Actual farms are much smaller. If you think about, if you could include them and actually help them apply good agricultural practices, which ranges from use of fertilizer, smart irrigation, and so on and so forth. Imagine the potential you could unlock in feeding the world.
Right. Robert, just a very quick follow-up. So you talked about, firstly, dietary expansion as being quite a challenge. So the affluent middle classes that are rising in many parts of the developing world, the emerging world, they are a factor for good, but also a factor for bad?
Yes, I struggle to put it that way, but I think what you want to say is absolutely right. Yes, I think it's for the bad, because if you think about, for instance, meat consumption is the most inefficient way of getting protein into your system, because it requires 3 to 7 times the same weight, if you will, in terms of compound feed to get it onto your plate. So this is already a challenge in terms of moving grain. But you can think of also, a bit further away from the food security issue, which is, things like obesity, right? Nutrition. I mean, do people actually know what they're eating? I mean, nutritional information, all those sort of things. I mean, we can talk about this for another 3 evenings. But to answer your question, yes, it's good, but it's also bad, because it actually drags on getting grain to where it's needed.
Right. I'm going to come back to you in a few minutes on the free markets and the trade implications. But Tassos, I wanted to ask you about the policy responses to the different challenges that Robert has set out for us. There are so many different areas that need to be worked on. It must be quite a puzzle for you, quite a complex puzzle for you, to come to grips with all the different threads in this.
Yes. Good evening, everybody. It is complex. That's why you try to simplify, knowing always that there is a risk in that, trying to do that. So the first question one has to ask is, what are the market failures that you have to address? Because we're talking about public intervention when you talk about policy responses. The second question you have to ask yourself is, what are the policy failures that you have to address? Because nobody's perfect. Now, in terms of the market failures, the first thing that concerned us, because we are, after all, on our part, responsible for the common agricultural policy, which addresses issues that affect European agriculture, is to make sure that you don't do damage to others. And this is an area where we have been reforming in many, many years. And as a result of that, the impact we have on world markets is minimal. The European Union has become the largest exporter of agricultural products, but this is mainly value-added products. And it's also, it has been and continues to be the largest importer of agricultural products, which mainly come from the developing world and are pretty mixed. Now, the real question, or we had the real pressure, since we're talking about sustainability questions, is how do you balance out the economic, the environmental, and the social aspects of sustainability? And the real dilemma was that in the context of what we faced up until last year, because the situation has changed right now, was that with very high prices of all commodities, including agricultural commodities, the farmers were faced with a real production dilemma. The markets are not going to pay for the environment. So from an economic point of view, your best interest is to forget about the environment and increase as much production and reduce as much economic costs. From a longer-term perspective, this is the worst thing that any farmer could do, and the great majority of them know that. So the real policy dilemma is how you arrive at a situation where the delivery of the private and the public goods are not competing against each other, but are brought together. And this is why the shift in our policy has been in moving policy instruments towards land use and land use changes. Mm-hmm. Now, it's one thing to design theoretically something, it's another thing to put it in practice, and in practice there are many things we can discuss that could have been done better, especially if we had simpler decision-making procedures. But the fact is that already, in an attempt to anticipate the challenges that we're going to face, this direction has been given. And what is positive also is that we have focused more on what would like potentially to turn into a virtuous circle of research, innovation, and advice. Research needs nowadays to anticipate previously unforeseen challenges. To give you an example, climate change, among other things, has an impact in the spreading of diseases, plant and animal diseases, much faster than what research is doing. Innovation requires the transfer of knowledge and best practices, not only to those that know it, and we have seen in the innovation partnership that we have introduced that those that are pretty advanced share this knowledge among themselves, but also to those that are lagging behind and will need it even more. And advice is something where almost all EU member states used to have in the past in terms of what, in my American English, I know as the extension system, but these have gone way back in most member states, and we need to bring them capable of advising farmers what to do. Now, in this overall orientation, the biggest challenges we're going to face in the future are about to come next month, because the largest two industries in the European Union, which is the food industry and the auto industry, are both going to face a challenge that has nothing to do with their traditional business. It has to do with emissions. It has to do with climate change and constraints. And the interesting element here is how you address that from a policy point of view. One way of addressing it is looking at agriculture as a sector. It's 2% of GDP, 1.7% to be exact. As such, you narrow your policy responses immediately. You can use agriculture as the 40 or 50% sector, which is a land use that it covers, and focus on the type of policy measures that are needed to make this adjustment. And you can also look into agriculture as the 100% sector, the day-to-day requirement to eat, to consume food. And as a result of that, you broaden completely the manner in which you see all your policy measures, both along the food chain, but also in the wider services. And this type of description also indicates that the challenge that we have to face from a policy perspective. Because I don't know of any other sector that in order to satisfy 100% of the needs of a society needs to do it with only 2% of its contribution to the economic impact. And that to a large extent indicates that whatever we have done, we still have a lot to do in order to be able to adjust to future challenges.
So I was very generous, Tassos. I didn't turn the... I need an assistant to do that, actually, so I'm sorry about that. But I do have a follow-up. You did talk about knowledge transfer and the challenge of knowledge transfer. I was wondering if you could just explain that a tiny little bit in the current environment of where prices are quite low, and obviously R&D, innovation, are going to be very top priority for the sector.
Yeah, I mean, we probably have entered after 10 years of turmoil where we have two enormous price spikes and two enormous price downturns into a situation where the cyber cycle of commodities, or however you want to call it, it's over. And things are going to settle at a lower price level than what we have seen in the past years. That implies that farmers have to adjust even much more in terms of productivity. And productivity does not only imply that you have to produce more. It implies you have to produce more with less. There is less land available. And there is also, if you want, less capacity to continue doing the wrong things that we were doing in the past simply because we didn't know how to do it better. Now, the type of new knowledge that needs to be generated will take some time. Mm-hmm. That's why we have doubled the money for our research, but we don't expect immediate responses the next 2 or 3 years. But there is a very interesting element of what we can do with existing knowledge that I will try to describe in your format. You don't allow PowerPoint, so because that's the one I wanted to show. But imagine the map of the European Union. And in this map, imagine that we're in 2050 and we allow current trends of climate change to continue. Our colleagues in the Joint Research Center in Sevilla have produced a map that has most of the areas or of the European Union brown or brownish because of the impact that current practices are going to have in agriculture. Now, if you take the best practices that exist today in the European Union and transfer this knowledge to other parts that have similar soil conditions, similar climatic conditions, then most of the European Union becomes greenish. Now, the real question mark and the real challenge we face is how do we take these best practices and transfer them around? And this is not only a matter of incentives. It's also a matter of better regulation, better implementation of existing rules, and it's also, you know, a matter of how we find the most appropriate way to consider that these challenges are together and there is something that we, you know, what we know, that it's not best if we keep it for ourselves, but actually if we share it with others.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much, Tassos. I imagine that that's even a bigger challenge when we're talking about the world, not just the European Union. So that's clear. So, Francesco, I'd like to turn to you, and a very simple question really for you is, what is sustainable food?
Yeah, thank you. A very easy one, and one that takes a particular spice. I work for a chocolate company, so as you can imagine, especially if you talk about food security, I think it's interesting to see how we can contribute. I'm sure we can bring a lot of joy to the world and that part of the world that can afford it. But then when it comes to food security, is really about agriculture and the fact that in our supply chain, it's mostly smallholder farmers that supply our key commodities. In this case, it's cocoa. So what is sustainable food? So I'll give you a simplistic answer from Francesco. There's nothing official with it, but it's kind of reflect the approach that I think it should be taken. To me, is food that is manufactured, generating a net positive impact on the value chain, and it's sourced from thriving farming communities. Now, it sounds all very lofty and nice, and no one can disagree. At the same time, though, it's very different from what we would have answered 10 years ago. When the kind of the whole corporate sustainability movement started, it was all about avoidance of the negatives, and you won't have child labor there, and you will pay enough to farmers there, and you will pay minimum prices. So it was about kind of clearing our name, kind of a CSR approach. You meet a standard, you reassure your consumer, and you're sustainable. Well, the bar has been raised, so my kind of initial lofty statement seems obvious. It's not when you start to implement it. And I'll take, I'll take. Are you measuring the time? I'm already running out.
No. This is quarter
okay.
To
so I'll. So I'll take the example of us and kind of our journey in cocoa, and chocolate. So again, we are a large producer. Most of what we buy cocoa is what. 99% smallholder farmers, 70% in two countries in Africa, and actually they clearly don't get enough money out of their crop. So the driver of doing more is purely a business driver. I need to secure my supply. So at the time when we look at that, we were already the largest buyer of certified fair trade cocoa, very large buyer of Rainforest Alliance cocoa. We looked at each other and said, does that solve our problems? No, it helps. It helped our journey. It helped engage our suppliers and the farmers, but still doesn't solve the business dilemma. Will I get enough cocoa and will there be enough incentives for those farmers to keep on growing cocoa? And that's where food security comes in. Does cocoa help them being food secure? Certainly not eating the raw cocoa, certainly not our chocolate, but indirectly if they make enough of their crop, if they diversify. So the logic conclusion for us is more investment directly in those farming communities and a 360-degree investment. So instead of top-down approach, these are the practices you will apply. I mean, that element still exists, is totally bottom-up and linked to those communities, which brought a whole new concept of basically almost building a joint plan with those communities and working with our suppliers to make sure we source from them. Now, again, I can go in endless details, but this was a bit of a revolution in the way we go about it as a company who sells branded goods. Now, it's a big investment. We wouldn't do it on anything. It made sense for our cocoa because it's big to us and we are big to it. So this is the thing. Main elements are focused on impact, not practices, not auditing few things. It's about real the progress that's made. And the bottom-up approach and the partnership, which was suggested before. Again, we do not know many of the things, and we wouldn't do. We wouldn't invest necessarily in infrastructure. And as you said, Cargill does, and Cargill is a major supplier. So these are the type of dynamics that needs to prevail.
Right. Francesco, one key element is consumer choice.
Yeah.
How do you convince or persuade a consumer to go for sustainable food rather than affordable food? What are the narratives that can be used, and what are the techniques or strategies that can be put in place?
Well, so we are talking about mainstream consumer.
Yeah.
I mean, consumer are, and you hear it everywhere, more and more conscious about sustainability issues. For them, though, it's a bundle, especially when you talk about branded goods. Is there a link to the brand, the story that's behind it, is what's relevant for them is the role it plays in their diet, the convenience of the food, and sustainability more and more. So if you talk about engaging mainstream consumer, what engages them from a brand perspective is the positive story, not the negative. I'm not saying you shouldn't deal with the negative, but what really resonates for the long term, creates fidelity, is the positive story. Again, think yourself as consumers, brands you trust. I repeat, is brand you trust because they do for you a number of things. So for us, pretending that sustainability story is going to be the lead from a consumer perspective that will drive all the change is utopia, but it is an important element in terms of kind of getting trust. And that consumer base is growing.
Okay, thank you. Hans Vermeil, you've been looking at these issues from the more academic point of view. You're involved in several projects, including with the European Commission. I was wondering if you had any comments to make on what you've heard. And also, my second question is really about how sustainable food systems fit in to the SDG, post-SDG discussion, Agenda 2030, and of course, COP21 and climate change.
Thank you. Thank you for this question. Yeah. To start with your last point, I think we are at a very interesting point in time. I'm very happy that food is back on the agenda because I think it was gone for years. The attention for agriculture and research in this area was really diminishing, and I think we paid also a price for it. But if we now look at the many of the grand challenges are in front of us. This reducing food security, fighting climate change, reducing dependency on fossil fuel. In a lot of things, agriculture is in the middle of it. And what you see is that all these big challenges are also connected. So you cannot look from one angle, I think, what comes in our food secure project, but you have to really have a consistent behavior. So what to see is that the big question is how can we feed these 9 billion people in 2050 and at the same time fight climate change, fulfill the agreements. I think the climate change is a requirement to get a sustainable food production, because I think if we don't do it, I don't think you get sustainable production at the end. What we find in our project is also that the macroeconomic story is quite important. So what's happening with economic growth? I think it was already told. You can look at it from a negative perspective, as the first speaker. But in general, if you look at poverty, it's the key thing to get people out of poverty. And that's good for food security. Where we did much worse is nutrition security. If you look at the millennium, there is a problem. So I think we should not talk about food security, but more food and nutrition security. Really make from food to nutrition to health. And if we then look at the literature for nutrition security, what you often, they look at very direct impacts, like is there a calorie intake, the income. But what you is often missing is all the basic services. And I really go back to the infrastructure, to institutional change, like infrastructure, education. And that's quite key to get a lot of people out of poverty. And that's not enough, because you need inclusive growth. Next to that, I think you look from a food system perspective. I think in a lot of the debates, it's much too narrow focused on agriculture. If you look at sustainable development goals, hunger is often related to agriculture. But I think we need first of all go to the food systems. I think the previous speakers more or less said the same. So take that into account. And then the climate change. I think it's Tassos already alluding to it. This can be quite a major issue, because if we really are serious to get to 2 degrees in 2100, that means a lot. I think that energy has to become then much more expensive. And our agricultural system and the rest is very energy intensive. Not only uses fertilizer, but a lot of energy. So the current system is really under pressure. That's from the supply side. But if you go to demand, to really, if you're serious about these targets, it's almost unavoidable that you have to use also bioenergy and biomass. If you the more strict are the targets, the more bioenergy you need. And then you get additional demand. So all in all, this creates a lot of pressures on the available land we have. So I don't think we can avoid doing research. I'm not sure whether the 4 billion that Tassos was talking about is enough. We could say there's 40 billion in European subsidies, and should we not? They are now directed at I think that is the key also advice of OECD. They are directed at minimizing the impact on trade. But that's also that you minimize the impact in principle on production. In principle, that becomes an income support or a social policy. If you really want to contribute, then maybe more money should be invested in productivity or production enhancing policies. The other thing is politics. I think we know we have the development goals, we have the visions. But I think what's needed is leadership. It has now to put into action. I think we know where to go. The millennium targets are very difficult. We need science to maybe to make things measurable, because everything is now voluntary. But I think that's important. And also government is quite key, that growth will be inclusive, that also the small farmers, the poor people will be heard, and that not only the people who are rich get in the political system all the leadership. So leadership in a chain, I think my neighbor is one of them. They can play an important role, so I think they are also responsible, but also the big retailers. If you see the concentration in retail and food processing, a lot of the chains can also happen there. And I think they have a responsible public-private partnerships, and they might be even more important than the policy makers. Reducing waste is a key thing. Still, according to some figures, a lot of waste. They are very different in the West than there is as much is wasted by the consumers and in the grocery stores. And in the poor countries, it's often at the farm. They need better drying techniques and infrastructure. Again, the other factors. So I think this asks for a transformation of agriculture policy, from agriculture to food policy, really also look at nutrition content, so not only on a stable cross crops, but think about food that is better from a nutrition perspective. And important is to take as many externalities into account as possible. It's of course impossible maybe, but you can make steps. So if it's creating a lot of greenhouse gas emissions like meat, meat should be more expensive. Then in, from an economic perspective, you try to eat less meat. Is fat a problem for obesity? Because we have not only 800 billion people of hunger, but we have also 1.5 billion people or whatever that are obese. So I think if that's a problem, then we should try to do something in incentive systems. But this is really economic. I'm not sure whether it will really work in practice. So I think at the end, we need also something from the consumers. I think we are moving into it, but I think we should also change a little bit behavior. So you need, in principle, also a preference there. This might start already at the educational level, at the primary schools, where we learn people what you eat has implications. My kids go to school, and I was just wondering, they learn nothing about these things. They learn nothing about the implications, and when you tell them, they're much more sensitive than often the adults who are already fixed in the food habits. So, no, I think this was my...
Yeah, thank you very much for that very, very, very valuable contribution. I was just wondering, Robert, do you want to come in on any of the points that Hans has raised about the importance of education, changing mindsets, improving innovation, research and development? Do you want to come in before I open the floor?
Yeah. There's many angles to that. I think when you talk, so let me give you two or three examples. Education can be at the farm level. So if you look at what we do, but what basically is a very good practice in our industry is helping farmers grow in a more sustainable way. Because you know what we said is true with regards to food production. I mean, in the last 40 years, we've increased, we've in fact doubled yields. In the next 40 years, we will probably rely on the food system to double yields again. The problem is that we've got so many drags today on the food system that we have to grow, we have to do it more sustainably. Mm-hmm. Okay, so education is going to be one way into making sure that farmers understand how they make use of you know, all the farm inputs, including water and fertilizer, to make sure that ultimately the crop comes to places of deficit. So education here is key because it requires the entire sector, including ourselves, so we take the responsibility to educate farmers. Another piece of education is maybe less obvious, but if you think about, and I like your example about children learning about where food comes from, we have, you know, and if you think about where your food comes from, literally, and you look at your bottle of oil, you look at your margarine, you look at your bar of chocolate, and you wonder what it consists of, and then you think about how all this is produced. I bet you not many people, well, people in the room, we have an advantage here, right? But not many people actually think about how food is produced. But only when you know how food is produced, you can then start thinking about how it is done sustainably. Because if that cognition, if you will, is not there, then you're not going to make the next step. So those would be two examples of how education plays into this.
Thank you very much. We've heard our panel. Important questions and interesting issues have been raised. I'd like to open the floor to questions from you. If I could ask you to be brief. First of all, put up your hand, identify yourself. If there is a member of the panel that you specifically want to respond to your query, then please say so as well. And I would make a plea for brevity because we have about half an hour, but we really want this to be interactive. So I see the lady over here, Leticia, and then the two gentlemen there. And I saw a couple of hands go up here as well. So please just introduce yourself for the others. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Céline Charveillat from Oxfam. Thank you very much for your presentations. I have two very brief questions. The issue of power in the supply chain has not been mentioned by anyone, yet it's probably one of the biggest factors that lead to farmers not being able to make a living. So what are you suggesting we change? The second one is closing the implementation gap. As is clear with the Volkswagen case, you can have policies, whether practices are in line with policy, whether the private sector is doing what they said they would do, whether European institutions are actually ensuring the implementation in their duties, you know, it's a big question. So how do you suggest we close the implementation gap after Paris when all those commitments will be made on the SDGs? And who will be the watchdog? The watchdog of the watchdog of the watchdog.
Yeah, absolutely. Tassos, okay. Would you like to take up this question? Take this one.
I mean, there is always going to be a gap between what you design in terms of policy and what is implemented on the ground. There's no doubt about that, and you will have it in every system where we will live, and we will always live in the real world. The way to minimize, if you want, the damage is, in my view, having seen what we've gone through, co-decision from the initial design of the last reform to the actual implementation of it, is to design something that is simple in its targets and simple in the measures that you have to implement. Here I have endless debates with my friends and colleagues from the academics. I'm an aborted academic myself. I think going in the logic of, one instrument, one objective, in the modern world where we have so many objectives, leads us in losing track of what we want to do. So I think in the initial stages of a policy reform, of a policy design, we should be extremely clear about what we want to achieve and how we are about to achieve it. And that would make it easier not only to have control mechanisms that would be able to catch this implementation gap, but it would be easier in terms of the transparency to have the rest of the society doing its role in monitoring in a more transparent way what is being placed. But having said that, I think part of the problem is that we're living in a world where we have very diverse attitudes and responses around the same themes. You mentioned also the food chain. Food chain is one of the big priorities of this commissioner and the previous commissioner. It's easy to generalize, but what we see is that with the same overall rules, with the same overall requirements, very different cultural aspects in terms of producer organizations have resulted in very different situations among member states. And you have very bad practices and you have very good practices at the same time. And I believe that in the world we live, it used to be a second bullet world, now it's a 140 character world. We have that tendency sometimes, unfortunately, to oversimplify. And for those of us that have to design policies, it makes our life a nightmare. Right? But that's why simpler in the beginning might help a little bit more so far.
Robert, from your point of view, implementation gap, how do you make sure it doesn't happen? Can you make sure it doesn't happen?
Can I make sure is, we have to have another debate on that, but I mean, can we work on this? Let me give two brief examples. So with regards to your organization, Johan Verburg actually was one of the people who approached me in terms of working on smallholder projects, right? This is one thing where I see, if you replace power by reach, right, we could use our reach to help smallholders connect to global markets and to actually use whatever we know about agriculture to implement good agricultural practices. So this is one example of your organization, but we have many of those, where we believe we can play a role. Another topic would be, if you think about the watchdog of the watchdog of the watchdog, I think, we can think about, how we put stuff in place with regards to, let's say, the palm oil supply chain. We work with NGOs to help us define the goals that will ultimately get us to the point of sustainable supply chains. We don't have all that knowledge, right? But we can help. We can help develop that knowledge. I mean, academia is part of this as well because we work with universities on the same thing. But we can actually put practical stuff in place. Really practical stuff in place with the help of NGOs and other stakeholders to make sure we have the right criteria. Those will be two examples that come to mind right now that I'd like to share with you.
Before I turn to the two other panelists, I'll take a couple of other questions. So the gentleman here, Leticia. Yeah, first, yeah.
Thank you, Thomas Arnold from the European Commission, DG RTD. Very often when we talk about the food system, we use the farm-to-fork concept. Now, seen from the circular economy, this sounds very much like a single journey trip. So, what would it mean to replace this with a round trip from biosphere to farm, fork, and back. A circular economy, okay, we all know a system where we close loops, where we minimize inputs and leakages. What does this actually and concretely mean for the food system in terms of closing loops which are not yet closed, in terms of avoiding negative externalities, of valorizing regeneration of the biosphere, in using waste instead of primary biomass, at least for energy and material use, or also just simply what would mean the sharing economy for the food system?
I think there are
many questions we haven't been addressing so far.
Thank you for that question, Hans.
Yeah, it's a very, very good question. But we just started a new project, I think, for your for your DG research, and it is about sustainable food and nutrition security. And for us, this is included in the concept. For us, you cannot have a sustainable food systems at the end if you don't integrate the circular economy and all these things inside. Because if you think about reducing the environmental impacts, then you have also to think about reusing all the materials again and again, because otherwise I never think you're going to make it. So there's no waste anymore, because all waste can be used. If you, for example, in the bioeconomy, you get biorefineries, you split everything, and every component you want to reuse, and you look at where it has the highest benefits. That's also for the businessmen the biggest concept. So I think if we go to the future, for me, that has to be part of a sustainable, I think, otherwise never we get there. And for the first question, I think the biggest problem with the sustainable development goals is that we do not get to this clear measurement, and we do not get to this clear indicator. So they are very, very good policy goals, but to get indicators for it, I think, is very difficult. So in this case, I might be even a little bit more pragmatic and go to Tasso's point that we should maybe be pragmatic and get to at least something that's measurable, because all the commitments are voluntary. So if you have no measurement, no watchdog at all, so what? So I think then it's better to have an imperfect indicator that you measure progress than instead of having a complicated measurement that is better from an academic perspective. Mm.
Thank you, Hans. Yes, please. You have your microphone right in front of you.
Well, can I just build on that with an anecdote? So in the past, it was the early days of footprinting, and one of the person in our R&D department said, oh my God, we need to get into this footprinting the company stuff and see which commodities plays in which role. And at that time, our vice president for global sustainability said, okay, yes, I get it. We need to get that perspective. And the guy said, oh yes, I need to go to that, whoever was doing the job, that will take us 5 months. And he said, 2 weeks, get our commodity data and just do your quick thing. Well, he's done it in 2 weeks. Probably he hasn't slept. But it was like 2 or 3% off the carbon footprint numbers. To your point, I think some of these numbers are so big, and they actually look very different from one company to the others and supply chain to the others, that I think pursuing precision is not what counts, is really the focus over what we do.
Right, Francesco Tassos, please.
Yes. Get in my shoes for the moment, because theoretically, from what you're saying, conceptually, I don't disagree, but what I thought when you asked this is exactly what Hans said, another research project. When the big problem we have, I think, is trying to get the facts right and put them in context. And I'll give you an example that I always have big question marks. It's waste. There is absolutely no doubt that there is a lot of waste. But the figure that we have in our mind, all of us, is 30% waste. Yeah. In a system that is based on profit, is it possible to have 30% waste? Somebody would have picked it up. 30% of what? Of the land use, of value, of quantities that you have to harmonize. And based on this, we tend to oversimplify the type of policy answers we had to give. The same thing was applied when people were throwing out, we need to increase production by 100%. Now everybody agrees that it has to be by 70%, but the starting point was 2005. Have we measured what we have done in the last 10 years? So that is, for me, that's the starting point. I come from a generation that we use to estimate our elasticities before we do analysis instead of assuming them. And that, I think, in the modern world makes a big difference.
Thank you. Leticia, the gentleman over here. Yes, please.
Good evening, Ludovic Weiss from World Vision. I would like to get back a bit on what Oxfam said before on food security and working with NGOs. I don't know if the gentleman from Cargill could give us some example of how do you work with NGOs, what kind of program do you implement, and how do you hold NGOs and the private sector accountable for each other? How do you hold each other accountable, and what about transparency? And a second question linked on nutrition security. In your program that you're implementing with the NGOs, do you look at nutrition outcomes for children and women as a result of your programs or actions? Thank you.
Okay, that's a number of questions. So let me try and memorize them. First of all, do we hold them accountable? But they hold us accountable as well. So I think the word progress was mentioned, or focus. I think Tasso said that. I think that's the key, right? Because once you start something, and let me give you an example of. Of a smallholder program we did in Malaysia together with Wild Asia and Solidaridad, which was basically around, okay, how do you improve livelihoods for smallholders in terms of, you know, when they grow palm oil, how do you make a better life for them in general? Once you start that, you've got an idea of where you want to go, and at the end of the day, you want to make it scalable, you want to make it scopable, if that's a word, but you want to make sure that you make progress. And rather than defining, okay, here's the list of 10 things you want to have achieved in 5 years, you actually start with the direction in mind, and you measure progress. And if you think about how Cargill, for instance, is measuring its progress in terms of traceability in our supply chain, because ultimately we want to provide that traceability in our palm supply chain. We say to ourselves we want to be traceable by the end of this calendar year to the mill, and we want to be traceable to the sustainable plantation by 2020. That's the end goal. How you get there? You hold yourself accountable, in fact, through public reports. That's what we do. But we work with NGOs because, first of all, we let them help develop the science together with academia. And the other thing is, once you've set those goals, you hold yourself accountable against the goals that you've set. That may sound a bit sort of circular, just to come back on the previous speaker, but it is actually circular because that's exactly what you do. Your second question is on the nutrition. So for us, access to food is not just access to food in the physical sense. It's access to safe, nutritious, and affordable food. So as a blanket statement, because, I mean, time doesn't allow us to go into a lot of detail, but as a blanket statement, I would say that is actually what we have in mind. When we pursue food security goals, we have those three things in mind. It must be safe, it must be affordable, and it must be nutritious. Because we're very, very mindful of what nutrition actually means in a transparent supply chain. Right. So this is some. I hope this answers your question. I've met you halfway, probably.
And the conversation continues over the reception and cocktails afterwards. So please feel free to bring up your issues with Robert and other panelists. I'm happy to take one question. I see two. You have a question, Ellis? Three? Okay, so now we have three questions. Please start here. Leticia, then this gentleman, and then there was another gentleman there. I make a plea for brevity, please.
Sure. David Reed from the New Zealand Mission. I wanted to pick up a point that you made earlier about areas of population growth being distant from the areas of production potential. And essentially, looking at food system, trading food is still incredibly difficult. It's incredibly distorted. Okay. Tariffs are high. Subsidies are high. All kinds of market distorting measures exist out there. Looking ahead to December and the Nairobi Ministerial of the World Trade Organization, it seems that the major players in that negotiation are still unwilling to make ambitious measures to reduce those distortions in the market. So looking ahead, do we have to expect a market that continues to be much more distorted, where it's easier to trade a car across a border than it is to trade food? Yeah. And what does that mean for sustainable access to nutritious food?
Thank you very much, Robert. I think I'd like you to answer
for me,
that first.
Sorry, I feel a bit guilty of asking. No,
I was going to ask you that question anyway.
Okay. We don't live in a perfect world. I think that's not a great statement to open with, but I think it's something we need to realize. What we as Cargill believe is that if you think about, and let me give you an anecdote and then I'll stop because that will hopefully explain the story. If you think about what the world would look like if everybody grew what it's good at, right? Argentina would be growing barley, China would be growing corn in the northeast, and it would be growing cotton in the south, and Brazil would be growing soybeans. Well, only the latter is true, right? Because Argentina doesn't grow only barley, and China actually produces soybeans as well, and it's the worst performing crop in terms of global yield. Now, so what does this anecdote mean? The anecdote actually is if you were to look at the world and you look at where crops are grown in the best way, it is not the case today. So the plea we're making, and I think that any economist would agree with this principle of comparative advantage, the plea we're making is that you grow where it's best suited and then trade. And the only stick behind the door, if that's a good expression, is that we say, look, over time, you see the center of gravity moving east, right? So it's moving away from places where the food is not grown. Literally, in that process, you need to take Africa along, because we believe that Africa is definitely the next breadbasket. It's highly underutilized in terms of yield, right? So you think about the fertilizer. In fact, you would lower fertilizer, you would lower cost curves, you would depress costs, and so on and so forth. I can go on like this. So this is what we plead for, but I agree with you that the world is not perfect.
Nairobi ministerial tassos looming ahead.
Yes, and that's why I'm happy that for the last 8 years I haven't dealt directly with these negotiations. We're still where I left it. Yes. But, I mean, let's be clear. It would have been to the benefit of everybody to come up with something, whether we come up with something which is going to be probably minimal. If at all, we'll have to wait and see. But we should not lose track of one fact. We have the same trade agreement for the last 20-something years, and trade has been growing. And people have adjusted to the situation. And in the meantime, we have had, at least in the developed world, major reforms. And from the three pillars of the traditional agreement, now you see domestic support playing a role in the emerging economies, but where we used to debate and fight each other over a 7 or a 10 year period of a 30% drop or 50% drop in tariffs, we have this type of changes in 7 or 10 weeks because of exchange rate or other commodity price fluctuations. So that's if you put all this in context, in an imperfect world, trade is still growing, and that's, I think, it's a good thing.
Thank you, Rajan. Before I turn to the other panelists, and you're welcome to come back to these issues, but let me take one more. There were two more questions. So the gentleman over here, and then there was a gentleman over there. Yeah.
Giovanni Colombo from Hill & Knowlton. Just one provocative question. I'm just wondering, given that agriculture represents only 2% of GDP, I don't know if it's a global or European figure, it looks like the income is heavily shifted elsewhere. And the question is, if we look at 20 or 50 years down the line, will it still be the same? Or do we think that a shift in income is still can still be avoided for food security reasons? Or it will happen anyway because of major food crisis or sustainability crisis? And if it will happen anyway, how can we guide the shift in income from other sectors back to agriculture in a way that is more sustainable during the transition?
So you were looking at tassos throughout. Well, but I'm actually going to ask Hans to answer
of
first.
Of course, anyone.
And then, then turn to the others.
Also, yeah, kind of interesting question. It's really also depending on what agricultural prices are going to do in the future. Eh? It's a very difficult question, because we had always this decline. In principle, the share of agriculture in the economy is going to decline in general. But in which matter, it's also really depending on what the food prices do. I think now they are getting back to their long-term trend, and this is all depending on what is going to happen with productivity, and especially yields and labor productivity. So it's also partly in the hands of policymakers and how much we invest in this stuff. But in general, you can expect that it is declining. I think you should not only look at the share of agriculture, but in credit, I think the term in the Europe is often used is bioeconomy. Then you have also the food, the forest, all these sectors inside. And if it's going to happen, what some of the commissioners here are saying, that you go to a bioeconomy and you might also going to use biochemicals and bioenergy, then biomass is playing a much larger share in the economy. Still, in an employment perspective, it's what Tassel said, it's still huge. From a land perspective, it's still huge. But in principle, when you get richer, you don't eat much more. So I think that therefore the share in income will decline. I think for the previous trade, in general, we have to comparative advantage is good, but then also we should have correct prices. So I'm not sure whether the fossil prices especially are the right prices, taking into account all effects, and then maybe it's too much. And I think we have to be careful that we not over-specialize too much given all kind of processes, because if all corn would be in one area of the United States and we get a draw there, we have a big problem in the world market. So to have several growth areas of all kind of crops, I think in the world it's just... because if climate change is more volatile, I think we have also to take into account if something goes bad for damage control. And that's the same also for countries. I think to really rely on food totally on other countries, you know, if something happened, it's a dangerous strategy. So I think you should also, smallholders, invest in local capacities to at least, if something goes wrong, that you at least have, if food prices in the world market go really high, that at least you have some local capacity. I think that's good for poverty and hunger. So specialization is good, but be careful.
Mm. Okay. Would you like to come in? I think I'll take one more question and then turn to you. So I had a gentleman over there. Yes, please.
Thanks very much for the opportunity. Nicolai, European Public Health Alliance. I just wanted to note a certain paradox between the global supply chains and nutrition security, because if we look at the rise of overweight and obesity in the Western world, which started around 70s, 80s, and what we see, the nutrition transition that's going on now in other parts of the world, where both undernutrition and overnutrition coexist sometimes in the same household. It has been clearly linked to a country's integration into globalized food supply chains and foreign direct investment by transnational food corporations. So something is clearly going wrong there. So I would like to hear your perspective on this. And it's still going on now at the very moment. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone else with a question? No. Okay. So, Francesco, why don't you start? Why don't you start? And please do tackle any of the other issues that were raised that you think are
Yeah, no, I think this one is very relevant. It's kind of the way I've started by saying, and I mean, given I'm talking about chocolate. So the point to me is, where does that systemic change and change in education Robert mentioned before needs to happen is in those same farming communities we are investing on. So those are the one that needs to diversify, those are the one that needs to understand about more food and how does that change. So, and somehow guided into resisting to the marketing powers, as you would say, and kind of make chocolate or the treats or anything that's maybe fattening part of a balanced diet. So the opportunity is an opportunity first and foremost of education, to me, and it's by deeper engagement that the education opportunity comes in. So 360 degrees programs of investment in farming communities should have that component very present, because I think especially if you look in certain countries, there's no other way. There's no kind of big centrally driven campaign mm-hmm. that could reach farmers in the way we do through our supply chain. So... Mm-hmm. That's my answer.
Thank you, Tassos.
I think it's deeply cultural, and it's not going to be a straightforward answer. I'll give you an example. I think it was 1999. I was still in the delegation of the Commission in Washington. My cholesterol went up. I was eating too much meat. I was in the U.S. So I called the doctor, said, what type of diet should I follow to bring it down. And instead of telling me what type of diet I should follow and start exercising, they answer, why do you want to change your lifestyle and you don't take some pills? I never went to this doctor again. I followed a different approach myself. But that shows that in terms of the type of responses you have, you're not going to have a straightforward answer. Even in terms of the new science that is coming up, we're doing an exercise of market outlook for the next 10 years. One of the biggest doubts we have and question is what is going to happen with meat demand. Meat demand, by the way, in the European Union has been going down and will continue to go down. In the US, it was going down up until last year, where a study came that said a little bit of fat is not bad after all. And both in dairy and all three meats, consumption went significantly up in just 1 year. So we can talk about nutrition. And I think it is important that we need to keep in mind in terms of the incentives we give in the policy to be aware of the potential health risks. But I don't see easy and straightforward answers to something pretty complex. Coming back on the issue you raised about income and the long term, I thought that Hans was going to raise it because you did a study for us on scenario 2020, didn't you? And this showed something very simple. I mean, if you take out all policies of agriculture, we will eat as Europeans, and Europe will produce food because it has been producing thousands of years. It's an old world after all. The big difference that the policy does is it balances out territorially the impacts of what you're doing. There are more people in remote areas, and there is less pressure on the environment. Is this perfect? By far away of it. There's a lot of room for improvement. But that's the impact so far. More territorial and environmental balance than in the absence of a policy. The longer-term trends about the share of the income will continue, but we shouldn't forget that there is about a generation and a half a gap between the most advanced and the least advanced from an agricultural point of view member states. And it will take some time for this adjustment to stabilize somewhere.
Hans, you were called on by Tassos to comment.
I could not better explain the study than he did. No, I think, it's a set of 2020. I think that's one of the key findings. So that the income subsidies play a role in keeping, especially because they are connected also to land. So if you get rid of it, I think Tassos explained all it, you will lose the marginal lands and it gets more concentrated in productive areas and you will lose also a lot of farmers because they need to have an income at the end. And so therefore I call it also the cap also partly social policy. And at least our studies agree with him that's minimally distorts production. So the impact of production is minimal. And the only thing is if food security is a problem, whether you want that, because it's a lot of NGOs and a lot of people ask for that it should not distort production. But where do you ask for? Because it's it also decreases production and therefore you get higher prices. But I think that's the general policy framework we are now living in. I think for the other one, for me to go to the one end obesity and the other end, I think it's a difficult one, and you really have to look from a nutrition perspective, but I have a feeling that it calls also just for a food policy, where you really try to take these things into account and really think not in terms of food, but in principle think in terms of nutrition.
Thank you. Robert, would you like to come in on any of these issues? Otherwise, I have a question for you, and that I think brings us back to the beginning in a sense. So do you think it's possible to have a sustainable food system by 2050? Is that possible?
Yes, I think it's possible. Of course, we need to then define what does sustainability mean. But I think we've seen a few definitions being reviewed tonight. So to answer your questions, Arda, yes, it is going to be possible. But the people around in the panel here are not going to do it by themselves. First of all, not the people, but certainly also not the companies and the institutions we represent. I mean, NGOs, for instance, are one. A partner, I would say, that we would mention in this, governments are. I think that at the end of the day, how can we do more with less?
is a very relevant question, but I think that at the end of the day, we need to understand that if nothing else, we need this would be my personal thing is we need to do two things. We need to make sure that trade is more free, and absolutely Tassos is right that trade has been, you know, freer over time, and that we engage the vast majority of farmers around the world who don't own 100 hectares, like I've seen in Brazil or somewhere else. We need to engage the smaller ones because it not only has an effect on in terms of agricultural practices, but it also has an effect on simply raising income, and food security then basically starts there.
Right, so to wrap up and very, very quickly, it's what I said in the beginning, it's a very complex mosaic in a sense where different things have to fit in the right order and in the right timeline as well. So the smallholder farmers, we didn't talk about women, but most of the smallholder farmers in Asia or in Africa are, I'm standing in for all the women here, but we have very many here. Smallholder farmers, many of whom are women, I repeat. Policies are important, but their implementation, I heard the word partnerships, I heard the word mindset changes and education. So I guess what we all have to do is really work together in a sense, but education, as Hans said and all of you have said as well, is going to be the key. And I have to say that I myself find myself in a situation where I'm being educated almost every day on these issues of sustainability in all their different facets. So I'd like to thank our panel for joining us and for making a strong, introduction into this topic and to set us on a track for the future as well, and also to all of you for your questions, for your participation. So join us downstairs for a networking reception, and once again join me in saying thank you for our panelists.